Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team talking biotech and pharma. I'm Jeff Cranmer, executive editor of BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues
Simon Fishburn, editor-in-chief,
Steve Usden, Washington editor,
Selena Koch, executive editor.
On today's podcast, takeaways from BioCentury's industry survey on anti-China bills making their way through Congress. And we catch up on Simone's conversation with Atlas Ventures' Bruce Booth. They talked everything from new modalities to the state of the capital markets. And we take a look at what it takes to get a therapy approved for an ultra-rare disease. Okay, as many of our listeners know, we've been following very closely legislation that is targeting Chinese CDMOs and genomics companies that is making its way through Congress. Since it began to gain momentum in late January, that's when the BioSecure Act was introduced. And as we've been discussing for the past couple of months, that bill and similar legislation in the Senate is aimed at preventing genomics companies BGI and MGI, as well as WuXiAppTec and their affiliates, from operating in the U.S. Since January, this has had a dramatic impact on the market caps of both WuXi entities. WuXiAppTec has lost about $15 billion in value, and WuXi Biologics has lost about $8 billion. That's after an uptick in the shares in Asian trading on Monday, after the champion of those bills, Mike Gallagher, announced that he would be leaving Congress. More on that in a little bit. What else? Bio came out against the bills initially until it changed course as John Crowley took over as head of the trade organization. So we went to industry executives and investors to find out how they're thinking about all this. And here to tell us a little about that is Simone.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, as you say, there's kind of a lot of introduction. I'll walk you through the data and we can discuss some of it. But at a very high level, my answer is not happy. People are very, very worried. We can talk with Steve about the likelihood of the legislation being passed as it is, but the way that it is shaped right now would really present a massive blow to biotech, according to our survey. I'll tell you another thing. You kind of know how big a topic is sometimes. We send out surveys, and when people are just answering immediately and then filling in all of those optional boxes for comments and filling them in with some little fairly colorful language, I would say as well sometimes, you know, you've kind of got a hot topic in the industry. So, you know, I'm just going to give you a couple of the real headlines. In this cohort, we actually had well over 100 responses that I'm counting here in a pretty short time. So over 90% expect pipeline delays. And I would say even more significant than that is two-thirds, 64% expect major substantial slowdowns in their pipeline. And that, and, I think,
sorry to interrupt.
So go ahead.
As they expect these slowdowns as a result of being forced to switch away from Chinese CDMOs.
Right, right. So that's what I'm saying. I think, you know, the primary thing is the idea that they can't use a China CDMO. To the second part that's really important to understand is that three quarters, so we actually had sort of over 140 responses, three quarters, 75% say they do work with China-based CDMOs. So only those people answer the other question. But as you say, the idea that they're going to have to change, find a new CMO or CRO to work with, is going to set them back significantly. An important part of that is almost all of them, like over 90%, said it would be difficult. 53% said extremely difficult to find a CDMO to replace, and 41% said challenging but manageable. But behind that, when you look in the comments, Real fears that this actually hits the small companies the most or the worst, because what they say is when there's a rush for everybody trying to find a new CRO or CDMO, they're the ones that get squeezed out. They can't compete. The big players will get in. They'll be fine. And it's the small companies that are going to take the heat of this. And, you know, that's really a bad thing for biotech.
Yeah, well, it seems like how big of a blow this is to individual companies might be related to, well, of course, how likely it is to actually pass, but how long it takes to pass. And then if there's any lag between passing and being enacted, what do we know about any of those possibilities, Steve?
So it also depends on how the legislation is modified, right? So there's two bills that are working their way through Congress. There's one in the House, there's one in the Senate. The one in the Senate was changed in response to some of the industry concerns. So it grandfathered in existing contracts with companies that would essentially be banned by the legislation. As I said in the story, though, on Friday, that raises a whole set of other concerns. Okay, how's the grandfathering going to work? One of the big issues is that typically companies have two sets of contracts with a manufacturer. One set of contracts is around producing material that's used for clinical trials or other things that they need to do prior to approval, right? And then they'll sign another contract when it's clear that they're going to get approval for commercial scale manufacturing. If the grandfathering on the bill works the way that the Senate bill has been modified, that's going to be an enormous problem, because it says if there's a contract in place at the time when the bill goes into effect, then that's exempted from the provisions. But contracts going forward wouldn't be exempted. So if you were a company that had contracted with a Chinese CDMO for clinical trial, for getting your biologics, for example, manufactured for clinical trials, and then the bill goes into effect, you might have to go somewhere else to get the commercial scale manufacturing done. That can cause an enormous delay. Even if there's capacity available somewhere in the world to do that, it can take years to do the technology transfer from one manufacturer to another of a complex biologic.
So I think that's a really key part of this, because we had a few write-in comments that really showed the complexity of this and, more importantly, the uncertainty of it, right? But I think that even with the uncertainty and even with this idea that maybe not everybody understands the full range of things, people know that switching horse to another manufacturer, even if they're allowed to do it, even if there is capacity, you know, that's a blow to them. And a lot of people need to make decisions before they actually know what's going to get passed, because that's how biotech is. You've got to make decisions in advance. I want to give you a few more pieces of color to this. Sort of at a very broad level, we found twice as many were opposed as supportive. So, you know, we had like 40% people were generally opposed with their comments, 18% were supportive. Another 16% thought that it was like well-intentioned, but poorly executed. And I say well-intentioned with quote unquote marks, because what they said is, you know, a certain number of people thought that there was a legitimate threat to U.S. manufacturing and that the U.S. should do more to shore up its own manufacturing capacity and reduce its reliance on China CDMOs. But they didn't think this was well executed. But I do have to say another thing, which is, you know, we sort of discussed this internally afterwards, you know, as we were going through this analysis. A lot of the sentiment really is that I would say that Wuxi and, you know, Wuxi earned its place. That 75% of people that use Wuxi do so because they really value the quality of what they get there and the speed at which they get it and the cost. And that came through with the comments about what they would have to look for to replace it. So, you know, it's not like any mom and pop store can just start manufacturing and replace Wuxi. They are quite well regarded in this. And that's aside from whether people feel that the US should have better manufacturing, whatever the fact is, you know, Wuxi have a very dominant position because they've built it.
And I think that brings up, you know, one of the big lessons from this experience. No matter what happens with this legislation, It's created an awareness of U.S. supply chain vulnerabilities in advanced drug manufacturing, especially for biologics, and I should say, in America's failure to invest in large-scale genomics data collection. The question is whether the industry and its supporters can turn that awareness into something positive, whether they can convince Congress and the administration to take steps that will enhance biomanufacturing in the United States and enhance American investment in large-scale genomics data collection. Both of those issues are going to take a lot of money, and they're going to take a lot of collaboration with the industry, and they're going to take a long time. They're not things that are going to happen overnight.
Well, that is a great segue for just the last thing that I wanted to mention on this, because Jeff, in the introduction, you talked about bio, which had sort of done a U-turn, as we call it in the UK, apparently an about turn. I didn't know that was not a global term, on its position.
180
is fine. Yeah. Either way, they totally reversed, right? I think we can agree on that. And, you know, we're going to find out whether in time whether this is a pivotal position time for bio. People were very dissatisfied with the way bio has handled this. So again, like almost 50% disagreed with bio's current position, which is supportive of the legislation. 20% agreed with bio. You know, there are people, as I said, who do believe this is a threat. There are people who have, you know, various opinions about it. The comments about bio were sort of seen as them caving to political pressure, spineless, pathetic, and disappointing on one. The ones who were more sympathetic thought that bio may decide that this isn't the battle it wants to fight on behalf of biopharma. But an important part of this is that even people who thought that bio was taking the right position right now really felt that it had not explained this to its constituents, to its members. So they really thought that, you know, maybe bio is doing the right thing, but you haven't explained the U-turn and you haven't explained your current position. And I think that is something that bio is going to need to heed and think about as it takes on its next battles and continues with this one.
I think that a key thing here also is going to be the extent to which bio's changing its position gives it a seat at the table and gives it some standing to modify this legislation to mitigate the effects, the negative effects that it would have in its current form on its members.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, Steve, this latest wrinkle with the sponsor and champion of the bill, Mike Gallagher, he was also behind the TikTok bill that the House voted on recently. He announced that he is leaving just as his legislation is gaining steam. What does it mean for the BioSecure Act?
So I think that his departure does take some steam out of the BioSecure Act, but it certainly doesn't scuttle it, right? The issue hasn't gone away. It may be a little bit easier now to find ways to address the concerns about vulnerabilities to China without imposing highly disruptive bans on access to CDMOs. I still think that there's a strong chance, though I'd have to say not a certainty, that Congress will enact some form of the BioSecure Act this year. John Molinar has been appointed to take over chairmanship of the committee from Gallagher. Molinar's more in step with his colleagues and Gallagher on many issues. For example, Molinar voted to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, while Gallagher cast one of the few votes against it. Interestingly, Molinar is not a co-sponsor of the BioSecure Act. He doesn't seem to have strong links to medical biotech, but his district includes Dow Chemical. He's interested in ag biotech and biomanufacturing of chemicals. The only issues that I'm aware of where he's taken a strong stance on life sciences issues involving medicines are on abortion issues. He's a strong opponent of abortion. He introduced legislation seeking to reverse FDA's approval of the abortion drug mifepristone.
So how should people be thinking about this, Steve?
I think in the big picture, you know, it underscores the fact that members of Congress don't understand the biotech industry. And in the absence of that understanding, and frankly, trust of the biotech industry, politicians are prone to well, really just to making up stories that are consistent with their worldview or their knowledge of other economic sectors, and then assuming that the bad things that they can imagine to be true actually are true. This isn't confined to fantasies about the Chinese military creating genetically enhanced soldiers or mind-reading technology. I think it also applies to concerns which are being expressed in the White House now about malign implications of artificial intelligence and life sciences also. I think it also shows that there's a depth of antipathy toward China in Congress. The Biden administration has explicitly rejected decoupling as a goal, but they're not in sync with the mood in Congress on that. Few, if any, members of Congress are willing to speak up publicly against measures that aim to constrain China, regardless of the impact on American companies. So I think that as this goes forward, one of the challenges for the life sciences industry is going to be to really define what the relationship between the United States and China should be in life sciences, and if there's a case to be made for making that relationship different from the relationship in other sectors based on the interests of U.S. industry.
All right. You can find all of our coverage on the topic on biocentury.com and in the show notes. Coming up in May, BioCentury's 24th Bioequity Europe Conference. Let's take a quick break and you can hear all about it.
For more than 20 years, Bioequity Europe has been where CEOs and investors gather to network, partner, and debate critical issues facing the biotech industry. In 2024, Bioequity heads to San Sebastian, Spain, in Basque Country, May 12th to 14th. Join BioCentury, EBD Group, and Regional Host Committee Chair, ICEOS Capital, in one of the world's culinary capitals. Don't wait, last year's Bioequity conference sold out. Visit bioequityeurope.com for more information.
Okay, we're back. And Simone recently sat down with longtime biotech VC Bruce Booth in an episode of the BioCentury show. We released it on Thursday. You can find it on our YouTube channel. They talked capital markets, new modalities, and much, much more. Simone.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, really the best way to find out about this is to listen to Bruce in his own words. Bruce Booth, of course, is not only a investor at Atlas, but himself is kind of an industry commentator. He does his own analysis at the end of each year. We talked a little bit about what he'd found in the 2023 year in review at a pretty high level. I'll tell you this, like Bruce's position is there's been a lot of what he calls belt tightening. This is a word, a phrase he used several times, belt tightening in biotech, by which I think he means a lot more capital efficiency, a lot less money being spread around and so on. And he says it's starting to pay off. We're starting to see the markets return some IPOs and, you know, a general thawing. He says, the private capital markets, there are areas where there's still some pain there. He says the VCs are still shoring up a lot of their own companies or their existing portfolio companies. And sort of one area where there's still a gap is with crossover investors, where it's just, you know, they just haven't, in the public markets, haven't yet really come back. And then another thing he talked about, we obviously talked a lot about modalities. I encourage people to listen, as I said, because he's got some pretty interesting ideas about how what he calls a sort of Cambrian explosion of modalities is going to play out in the long term. But he also had cited some data that it was actually from IQVIA on industry efficiency, by which he meant, or R&D efficiency, sort of the numbers of programs that progress from phase one to two or to three or to four all the way, when I say four, regulatory all the way. And from 2017 to 2022, the industry's efficiency in progressing programs has overall gone down by a fair amount, like from like something like 16 or 17% to like 6 or 7. And, you know, you would hope that the industry is getting more efficient, not less efficient. And there are a few. Go ahead, Steve.
I wanted to stop you there because that actually did jump out at me. I'm wondering if you can describe a little bit about how efficiency is defined, because people may not share the same definition, and also maybe some ideas about what's behind it, and is it a temporary blip, or are we, you know, heading into disaster?
I'm going to stop. You know, I'll answer those questions, but let me just say, no, we're not heading into disaster. Okay, maybe for other reasons, but not for that one. We might stop short of disaster. But the yes, yeah, so regarding how the numbers come, they're sort of based on a 10-year trend of what they call composite success rates. So what IQVIA did is they looked at the proportion over 10 years that had gone from phase one to two, and then from phase two to three, and so on. And then the composite success rate is, you know, aggregated across all of those individual parts and phases. And so that is their, it's a sort of clinical trial efficiency measure, as it were. But I think that to your point about what's behind it. So Bruce Booth talked about three parts, one of which I thought was particularly interesting, and that is the inherent risk of new modalities. And he says that really bears out in phase one and phase two. And, you know, he says that the increase in risk there, in particular in phase one, is a good thing, because this is when you find out that if you, say, can't get your drug to where you want it to go, or that there's immunogenicity or other challenges. So as innovation goes forward and you try these new modalities, you have to expect some more failures. And you find these out in phase one and sometimes in phase two. But that is what I would say, or you could argue, is sort of a healthy part or part of the price you pay for increased progress, which is why I say, no, it's not a disaster. You would hope that over time, right, that attrition due to that would decrease, or, you know, unless there's many, many more new modalities coming through. But there are some other factors in attrition. One, which I know is close to what you cover, is inconsistency with regulatory goalposts. You may agree or not, he thinks that's kind of cyclical. He thinks that you go through eras where regulators do this, and, you know, that just gets harder.
I think that's a myth. I think there's this idea of the pendulum, that somehow that there's some big pendulum and it swings toward risk or it swings toward caution. I actually don't think that that's true. I think that people's perceptions of it change in part based on which administration is in power. But I don't think that's true. I think there is inconsistency. And I don't think that it's a pendulum that waves back and forth. I think it's probably, if you were to look at, be like an oscilloscope with a lot of ups and downs and noise, rather than, you know, waves that go in different directions.
And, you know, to that point, I don't know whether that maps onto new modalities, whether there was a difference between the 10 years into 2017 and the 10 years into 2022. But it's a fair point what you say. And then the last thing I just wanted to point out is that actually he thinks the number may go down, because he says that from the bear market, there are still a lot of companies that went under. And so those will come out still as terminated programs. That's how the numbers are done. And so, you know, the numbers may get worse before they get better.
All right. As Simone said, you can hear all this in Bruce's own words at biocenturyyoutube.com. Last week, FDA approved a gene therapy from the Orchard Therapeutics unit of Kyowa Kirin for metachromatic leukodystrophy. It's an ultra-rare genetic disease. The therapy is Lenmeldi, and Selena says it offers an example of getting a drug approved for ultra-rare diseases, something that is not that easy. Selena, what did you find?
Yeah, well, that is exactly why we decided to write about this particular FDA approval. We have seen, of course, that sometimes with the less rare of the rare diseases, with their relative prevalence and the provisions of the Orphan Drug Act and the high prices these therapies can command, you put all those variables into an algorithm and there can be a commercial case to be made there. But for the ultra rare diseases, you put those numbers in and the business case gets really tough. So it's why examples like the Orchard one are important to kind of look at, particularly because it's not unheard of, but it's very uncommon for FDA to grant full approval on so few patients and with no randomized controlled trial data. So that is what happened here. There were 37 patients in a couple of single arm studies and an expanded access program, no RCTs. The trial patients were compared against what's known from natural history. So natural history, of course, is really useful in helping us understand how a disease progresses and how it might be modified by a therapy, but it never makes a perfect comparator. And we saw that here with these patients in the natural history part of the analysis being found because of their symptoms, whereas those enrolled in the study were, of course, found because they harbor this gene that causes the disease, and most of them were pre-symptomatic, so that different phases of disease. Nevertheless, I think what stands out is the efficacy signal. So not only has the FDA made it clear that in cases where diseases are very severe or lethal, like this one, and very rare, and there are no treatment options, will it, you know, consider this kind of thing, but you also need to have an efficacy signal that's compelling, right, to cut through the uncertainties that come from these imperfect comparisons.
So, Selena, do you think that there's a read-through or kind of lessons learned from this experience for other companies and especially patient groups who are really hoping for FDA approvals for these extraordinarily rare conditions?
Probably. I mean, yes, there are many rare, ultra-rare disease therapies just languishing in pipelines, right? Because you can't really make the case to bring them forward. So examples like this, I think, are very important for that reason. Now, we've seen some idiosyncratic decision-making over there at FDA, so you never can be totally sure, but it certainly signals a willingness in cases that meet certain hallmarks, right? So this is a genetic disease, and the company offered a genetic solution, and the biological rationale is straightforward. They're missing an enzyme that leads to all kinds of trouble. You could give that enzyme back and code it as a gene right to the heart of the disease biology. Very clear case biologically. Again, severity, rarity, checks those boxes. And then there was a survival benefit that seemed big enough that even in the context of small imperfect data, there was probably real. So you gotta have that signal has to be strong and clear.
All right, thanks for that, Selena. You can find a link to Selena's story in the show notes. And coming soon on biocentury.com, Steve's analysis of Tuesday's Supreme Court hearing on the abortion pill, and our colleague Paul Bonanos profiles Jay Lichter's venture firm, Avalon. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next week. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, and inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.